Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Fran Dugas and Heather Fallon. Today, we are delighted to feature Gabriela Garcia, author of Women and Salt, published by Flatiron Books in March 2021.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a fun idea. Today, we are drinking a salty mist inspired by Gabriela's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
For those not familiar with Gabriela's work, among other accomplishments, Gabriela Garcia's fiction and poems have appeared in Best American Poetry, Tin House, Iowa Review, and elsewhere. She has received a Rona Jaffe Fiction Writers Award, a Steinbeck Fellowship, and residencies and fellowships from Breadloaf Saraband Books, Lighthouse Works, the Keller Estate, and the Community of Writers at Squaw Valley. She has a BA in Sociology from Fordham University and an MFA in Fiction from Purdue, where she has also taught creative writing. The daughter of immigrants from Cuba and Mexico, Gabriela was raised in Miami and currently lives in the Bay Area. She is a longtime feminist and migrant justice organizer who has also worked in music and magazines. The New York Times says of Woman and Salt, in this debut novel, the daughter of a Cuban immigrant is haunted by the desire to learn more about her history, setting in motion a multi-generational family story that leaps across the Americas.
From the 19th century cigar factories to present-day detention centers, from Cuba to Mexico, Gabriela Garcia's Of Women and Salt is a portrait of betrayals, personal and political, self-inflicted, and those done by others that have shaped the lives of these extraordinary women. A haunting meditation on the choices of mothers, the legacy of the memories they carry, and the tenacity of women who choose to tell their stories despite those who wish to silence them. This is more than a diaspora story. It is a story of America's most tangled, honest human roots. We are so looking forward to talking to Gabriela today about this book.
How are you feeling today, Gabriela?
I'm feeling good. It's a beautiful day here in Oakland, and I'm feeling good.
Wonderful. Well, we're looking forward to talking with you about your work and also having you give us a reading later. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
I do. You know, I miss it since everything I've been doing has been virtual, and it's been so lovely to see so many people show up and participate, especially this far into virtual stuff. But it's definitely a different energy than reading in person, and I do sort of miss that.
Yeah, I think it is a different energy. I'm curious about the origin story of this novel, Gabriela. Can you tell us where the idea first came to you, where you first began writing it?
Yeah, I think there are various origin points. I sort of arrived at it from different places. And I knew that I wanted to kind of write a fractured narrative that didn't follow a sort of traditional story structure. And each piece kind of has a different origin point. So, for example, some of the opening chapters take place in a 19th century cigar workshop where writers are read work from Victor Hugo and other authors that were sort of popular in the writing workshops. And that origin point was a trip that I took to Cuba. And I went to this museum where they had on display some of these letters from Victor Hugo to workers and independence fighters of the time. And I became really fascinated with that sort of interplay between the literary and class consciousness and the political movements of the time. And so that was sort of what sparked some of that research and interest in writing that historical chapter, which was very much a different mode of writing for me. Like, I don't normally write historical fiction. And then other pieces sort of came from different places too. Like, there's a chapter from the perspective of a woman in a detention center in Texas. And as you mentioned, I worked as a organizer for many years, in particular working on deportation defense work. And I was working with a lot of women and families in detention. And I started writing some of the snippets of what would become that chapter while I was doing that work in detention centers in Texas, and sort of never thinking that it was going to be a novel or anything like that. It was like way before my MFA or any of that, but it was just sort of my own way of processing some of the work that I was doing. But I ended up working some of that into creating that chapter. And yeah, every chapter sort of, I think, has a different origin point for me, but it's mostly a collection of all the kinds of obsessions and various things I was thinking about you know, as I was putting this together.
Well, they came together beautifully. I love the idea of multiple origin points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's actually really interestingly related to the next question that I had for you, which was, as I was reading this book, I had a really strong sense of place and setting influencing the narrative all the time. So I felt like Cuba, Mexico, and the United States are all such important settings in this book in terms of culture, expectations, the way the characters are depicted. Can you speak in terms of how setting informs or is informed by your writing choices?
Yeah, that's great to think about. You know, I think I'm really only able to write about places that I know intimately well and that I have some kind of distance from as well. Like, I have found that moving away from Miami allowed me the space to really sort of see it from a different perspective and be able to write about it. I think that even some places that I've lived in for years, like New York, I rarely wrote about because I felt like I needed more of that distance and just to know it more intimately. And I'm always thinking about detail when I'm thinking about setting rather than just conjure up the place. I want to sort of show it from the perspective of the characters that I'm writing about. So I think that's part of why I was so interested, for example, in the Cuba chapters, in writing them from two different perspectives. One is Jeanette, who is a daughter of immigrants traveling to Cuba for the first time and sort of coming in with her own perceptions based on what she heard growing up in Miami and her own sort of biases. And so she has a very particular way of seeing Cuba and thinking about Cuba. And then there's another chapter from the perspective of her cousin who lives in Cuba, and she has a very different way of seeing it. So I'm often thinking of every craft element sort of in favor of another craft element. And I think setting can illustrate a lot about character and obviously about plot and every other thing. But I like really thinking about character, how these characters experience their settings.
Oh, yeah. And it seemed to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed to me like a lot of the focus of many of the narratives was interpretations of reality based on that individual's experience. And so kind of treating the reader to multiple facets of how people could perceive the same situation. So interesting. The novel also has topics as complicated and divisive as substance abuse, molestation, child abandonment, immigration issues, including run-ins with ICE, and other serious important topics. That's a lot. You loaded a lot into this book. So how did you choose many of these things to feature, and at what level of depth? What were your writerly choices for that? And also, this is just a curiosity question, but what was your favorite character in this book?
Yeah, I think I wasn't sort of thinking of it in that larger way as I was writing each of these characters, but I was sort of thinking about a lot of it takes place in different time periods and a lot of these characters aren't necessarily in dialogue with each other across generations, but there are all of these sort of echoes in their lives or these ways that these characters that they may not even know are affecting their present day reality in some way. And so I was sort of interested in that and really tracing some of that intergenerational trauma and also the ways that not disrupting that or not facing some of those difficult conversations for these characters results in that sort of echo across time. But yeah, I mean, again, I think as I was writing, I was just sort of kept turning back to some of the obsessions that I had or the issues that are just constantly at the forefront of my mind. And in many ways, I sort of wanted to trace a story of all of these different women who are sort of forced to survive in these very patriarchal worlds.
Yeah.
But I wanted to do it in a way that just solely centered those women. You know, the whole book is in the perspective of different women. And while there are characters who are not women, they're sort of at the periphery. It's really sort of about how they navigate these worlds and are in conversation with each other.
For those of you who haven't read Of Women and Salt, as Gabriella says, there are multiple points of view and there are also multiple time periods. So each chapter seems to change character and time and often place. I was wondering, Gabriella, if you could talk a little bit about the drafting process that you had when you were working on this book and how did you connect all the pieces of the story?
Yeah, so I sort of knew early on that I didn't want a kind of linear, traditional story structure, sort of thinking about what we think of as traditional story structure being so focused on European modes of storytelling and Aristotle and the hero's quest and all of that. I really wanted to sort of think about other ways that people tell stories. And I was kind of thinking about what it feels like even when I'm having a conversation with my family around a table.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. And it'll sort of jump from one place to another. And some of it might be like reaching into the past, or might be two very different interpretations of the same story. And so I kind of wanted to approximate that kind of feeling, and also the way that historical accounts sort of work, that there are all of these spaces of sort of unknowing or very specific perspectives that come through, and what that means for the telling of the story. And so, yeah, in that way, it's sort of a very kind of fractured narrative, you know?
Yeah.
It's jumping across time. It's jumping across character. It's even jumping in perspectives, sometimes even within the same character. And so that's sort of what I was really interested in.
Yeah. My question is, I'm always interested to know, how did you get from draft to publication? Can you talk a little bit about your story, about finding an agent, about being on sub?
Yeah. So I drafted the book during my 3 years of my MFA. And I think probably when I graduated, I would have revised and worked on it for another 1,000 years before I sought out an agent. You know, I didn't think I was ready. But my publication story is a little unusual because a bunch of things sort of happened at the end of my MFA. One of them was that I won the Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award, which is awarded to emerging women writers. And it's sort of a high profile award event in New York City, and a bunch of agents come to it and everything. And then the other thing that happened is that one of my mentors and professors, Roxanne Gay, who's just been like an incredible supporter of my work, tweeted about the book because she was on my thesis committee. So I started to hear from a bunch of agents, basically,
yeah,
who wanted to read the manuscript. And I was sort of flustered, like, I'm not even ready to send this out. But I felt like if I didn't, you know, just take advantage of this moment when they were interested, I would sort of lose it. So I just kind of sent it out to, you know, everyone who asked. And that's how I ended up with my agents, who I love dearly. And then I worked on it with them for a little bit. And then, yeah, then it went out to editors and I had a really great response. Ended up with Megan Lynch at Echo, who has just been great. But then she ended up leaving Echo to Flatiron and actually ended up taking me with her there. So it was kind of a long process between the time I sold the book to Echo. It was like 2 years before it was published by Flatiron.
So interesting, all the connections along the way. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
How did it move from one to the other, though? If Echo had bought it, then Flatiron bought it out from Echo, or how did that work?
Yeah. I'm not very involved in like the business stuff. Like, I don't know a ton about it. So I'm sure there's all kinds of details about how that happens. But I know,
okay,
what I know is that basically my editor was really interested in working on the book. And so, yeah, she basically bought it out from Echo's parent company, which is HarperCollins. And then it moved to Flatiron. But I think all kinds of things can happen in that scenario. If your editor leaves to a different editorial house, you can also end up working with a new editor at the current imprint. Yeah. So I think that that's actually not that uncommon to end up with your editor leaving and
right.
A new editor. Yeah.
Well, that's amazing that you had someone who was such a champion. They wanted to take your book with them. That's great.
Yeah, she's been wonderful.
So I'm also interested in the politics of language in this book, in the bilingualism, the kind of biases, implicit and explicit. Can you speak to your writing choices made around language? Because I think that's really key.
Yeah. I mean, I think how language is used is often tied to envisioned audience. And this isn't like a new idea for me. I feel like way more people have written about this and thought about this before me, and I owe a lot to them. But I sort of, when I was writing it, was kind of like writing to myself, which meant not needing to define Spanish terms for myself since I am bilingual, or overly explain certain things. I kind of wrote in the way that made sense to me if I was reading this book.
Oh, yeah. We've even had BookTales authors on the series before who have talked about deliberately not italicizing foreign words because they felt that that was a choice that they were making when they put Spanish or other languages in their texts.
Right. Yeah. So I don't italicize any of the Spanish words. And I also wanted to sort of be accurate to some of the intricacies of language. Spanish in itself varies across countries and also even just how it's spoken in different parts of the U.S. And so there are words in Spanish, for example, in Cuba that probably people who are not Cuban or familiar with Cuban Spanish might not entirely catch on to, but I wanted to be true to that. And there's a chapter in which a character who is Salvadoran and has been deported to Mexico is sort of reflecting on the ways her language changes in Mexico.
Yeah, this is the section with Ana, right? Is that Yeah, definitely. I loved that. Yeah.
And it was sort of important to me to be clear that like these are Latinidad is not a monolith. Even language, Spanish is not a monolith, and to be sort of true to my own understanding of it.
Yeah. I'd like to talk a little bit about memory, especially memory as structure and theme in your writing and in the writing of this book. Your novel feels a lot like bursts or glimmers of memory, which in the core, of course, because of the nature of them, can make reality sometimes questionable. I was wondering what role memory plays in the stories for your characters.
Yeah, I think memory to me is so fascinating because two people can have entirely different memories of the same event. And it can shape how they live their lives and how they interpret their world. And that's very much the case for many of the characters in the book. They're sort of working from a place of understanding the past in one particular way. And a lot of the sort of miscommunication or friction between some of the characters comes from the ways that their memories don't align. And I think this is true on that sort of micro level of these individual characters interacting with each other, but also is sort of the way historical accounts work, that there are these very limited perspectives and that you have access to just often one particular story. And that's something that's sort of also interrogated in some of the historical chapters. And so yeah, I was thinking about how memory informs the present and how that sort of sets these characters in motion in terms of how they interact with each other.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for me, your novel is very much about storytelling and the interaction and the interdependence of the history of one character on the future of the next. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was kind of great how each of your characters has a story to tell and a story to pass on, or specifically to not pass on or hold on to and keep private. Since these characters are women, I was thinking a lot about the significance of gender in this book. And I also kept coming to me this idea of maiden, mother, crone, because I felt like not only did you have these intergenerational narratives, but you also had women at different stages in life. Did you start out thinking you were going to have all of that too?
I knew that the book was going to center women, and I've almost exclusively write women, and even in my short stories and my poetry, I've always just been very, very interested in relationships between women in particular, whether that's like mothers and daughters or sisters or friendships. So I'm just very, very interested in sort of women's relationships. I was also really interested in just how at different stages of these women's lives, they are interpreting things differently or seeing things differently based on their own sort of accumulation of experiences. And I wanted the writing to also match that in many ways. For example, there are all of these sort of point of view shifts and style and tone shifts, sometimes even within the same character, like the chapter sort of toward the end of the narrative, Other Girl, in which Jeanette is sort of descending into this toxic relationship and into her addiction. And the writing is a lot faster. It's in first person. Mm-hmm. It's sort of more intense. The sentences get a little bit longer. And yeah, so I wanted it to mimic the stage that she's in at that point, her mental state, which is different from when she's younger, which is different from other points of the narrative. So I was interested in that too, you know, sort of how these characters across time shift in the way they see each other and the world.
One of my favorite characters was at the very beginning, Maria Isabel, and a line that comes through that chapter and really is in many of the characters and chapters is the saying, "We are a force," which is found in the copy of Les Miserables. And the idea really resonates through her story in particular, but the other characters. I was wondering if you could talk about that phrase a little bit, how it found its way into the novel and what it means to you.
Yeah, so a lot of the sort of source material in that chapter is based in real material from that time. So that phrase is taken from an actual letter from Victor Hugo to workers at the time, to women at the time. And a lot of what we're talking about is sort of what I was interested in that chapter, in terms of history and perspectives. I was really interested in this idea of Maria Isabel and how she's sort of finding a kind of freedom and new perspectives through literature during that time. And at the same time, sort of keenly aware that so much of that literature is coming from a very specific perspective, which is almost always European white men or sort of European white Cuban men, and sort of how she's able to sort of morph those words or reclaim them, allow them to just be hers. And so I'm often thinking about words and phrases that can take on different meanings, or even images that can mean a lot of different things. Like, that's always interesting to me. And so I really liked the word force, and I really like that phrase, because I think, again, in some of the way that the book works, like kaleidoscopically, it can sort of take on different meanings or mean different things depending on how you're looking at it and at different points in the book. And it can be force as in a strength or a sort of historical force that connects these generations, or it can be also the way some of these circumstances are sort of forced on a lot of these characters. It can just take on so many different meanings throughout the novel, and the characters also sort of allow it to take on different meanings, add words to the book that's sort of passed on through generations, that kind of thing.
It really is a potent word, and I like the idea of her reclaiming that also.
Yeah, I was sort of interested in whether that reclamation was even possible.
Yeah, totally.
And exploring that through the way the book kind of passes on through generations.
Yeah, and I think that that's one of the most interesting things reading this book too, is how the characters are really of their own time in each of the different segments. And at times, the book also seems kind of a historical chronicle of the views of racism, maybe here and there. So I thought that that was very interesting to reflect on the significance of the politics of the book. When I'm thinking of pages 140 and one through 141 in particular, when the book says, "But it isn't as though Black Cubans fare better in Miami, where racism is just slightly more polite, a little quieter. This is fact. In Miami, Cuban is synonymous with white. In Miami, Cubans will scoff if you call them Latino. I'm not Latino, I'm Cuban, they will say. By which they mean I am white, another kind of white you don't know about, outsider." Whoa. Right? You're taking some deep things on here and you're bringing it right to the fore, which I really appreciated. Were you hoping readers would complicate a simpler view of race when they saw the variations in this book that it brings to the fore?
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, throughout the book, I'm really thinking about the force of history and how that shapes a lot of the contemporary ways that they're interacting with each other, or like particularly in the case of Carmen and her sort of very privileged position in Miami, how that's tied into even the ways that projects of blancamiento, or of basically purposely trying to whiten the population of Cuba, which is something that was happening in the 19th and 20th centuries, how that sort of influences who Carmen even is at that point of the book. And Latin America is very much a colonial project, much the same way as the U.S., in which there was white European hegemonic control. But I think some of that is often lost in conversations of Latinidad, in particular in the U.S., where this idea of like a monolithic identity is often imposed on the population that doesn't allow for sort of exploring issues of race and class and privilege that very much have shaped populations, and absolutely, definitely the Cuban American population in Miami in particular. Mm-hmm. So I was very, very interested in kind of exploring that and the very different realities some of these characters experience, for example, such as Carmen, again, this privileged sort of Cuban character in Miami, and her neighbor Gloria, who was from El Salvador and came under very different circumstances. And there isn't like an automatic solidarity between these characters. There's not, you know? And so I wanted to explore that in many ways.
I wanted to talk a little bit. You mentioned generational trauma earlier, and I feel like trauma impacts many, if not all, the characters in your novel. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how, if you think trauma can be passed down from one person to another, and also your experience in writing about trauma, which can be very challenging.
Yeah. I mean, I think in much the same way that not facing historical truths results in sort of unresolved intentions or misunderstandings or problematic behaviors, the same thing sort of happens on a character level. These characters not facing the sort of historical truths of their lives or not wanting to name things or talk about them results in sort of that intergenerational trauma that you're talking about. And that's sort of what's happening in a lot of the book. And
right.
A lot of just not wanting to face the thing, not wanting to talk about it, wanting to bury these things sort of has these tragic consequences.
Yeah.
And yeah, it can be really hard to sort of go to some of those darker places. I think when I was in the draft stage, there were times where I sort of wrote around some of the pieces that felt darker or like just a place that I didn't want to go to, you know? And oftentimes I had really great teachers who would sort of point out some of those places and encourage me to sort of go to the place that I didn't want to go to have it feel more truthful. And I think they were right. I feel like often when I don't want to write something or I'm sort of uncomfortable there, like that can be the place where there is the most truth or the most deep sort of excavating in terms of character.
It's hard to make yourself go there. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And it's kind of the concept of right where the blood is, right? Where sometimes there's something very powerful in exactly what you're trying to avoid writing about.
Yeah. I think that's a lot of what sort of some of my teachers were pointing to. And so I think it did become stronger when I sort of allowed myself to explore some of those uncomfortable places.
Yeah. I was very interested also, since I'm a poet, that you write poetry and that I recognized a lot of poetic turns of phrase in the novel. A lot of your style as a writer has a very poetic formation to it. How do you feel poetry writing has informed your novel writing, or vice versa, if that's the case? And also, do you feel like there's a difference in your role as a poet and your role as a novelist?
Yeah, so I love poetry. I have written, published some poetry, and I read a ton of poetry. And I think it absolutely like informs my writing. And I think one of the best things I ever did for my writing, for example, was to take a poetry workshop. And I think it probably has affected the way, in particular, I think about sentences, or I think about the language and the sound and the rhythm on a really granular level. But I also, you know, I'm often just thinking of different modes of writing. They're sort of just interconnected. Like there's been, for example, pieces that I've worked on that I'm like, I don't know if this is like flash fiction or a prose poem, or like, yeah. I don't know what it is. But to me, it's sort of just like different modes of the same writing. But I always like recommend reading poetry to all fiction writers. And I think often when I'm stuck or like the language isn't coming to me, I'll read poetry even before fiction, and it sort of opens up pathways for me.
Oh, yeah.
That's so funny, because for me, I feel like it's hilarious. I feel like I have two separate identities. When I write poetry, I'm a sex and love poet. That's where I'm going. Tragedy. That's what's happening.
That's so
then
funny.
I write feminist dystopia, experimental fiction, all kinds of different things, but not in the poetry. It's always one vein the poetry gets used for. Isn't that funny? So yeah, wonderful. Well, fascinating. I am looking forward, and we are both looking forward, to hearing you read an excerpt from Of Women and Salt. But before we do that, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Today's cocktail is called a Salty Mist, and the recipe's on the blog if you want to make it and drink and enjoy it while you listen at home. Here are the ingredients. It's 2 ounces of rum, 1 ounce of fresh lime juice, an ounce of simple syrup, a couple of dashes of Angostura bitters, 3 mint leaves, and 2 ounces of soda. If you want to make it a mocktail, which is what I've done today, I've substituted the rum for black tea, and it's really delicious like that. You get your martini glass ready, you salt the rim and you chill it, you muddle the mint leaves, and you shake it all together except for the soda. You shake it with ice and you strain it into a glass and you top with a little soda. And if you want to be fancy, you can put a mint leaf on top.
Great. So Gabriella, is there anything you'd like to tell us about the passage you're going to be sharing today?
So it's the beginning of chapter 4, and it's sort of Jeanette, kind of the main character in the book, at a younger age when she's like 15.
Okay, great. Go for it.
Johnson's lips were rubber clams. His breath was stale and hot, though the sand pricked cold against Jeanette's back. She turned her head when he tried to kiss her again, as if by looking away, nothing was happening, nothing but the ocean at her side. It's never really dark in Miami Beach, even on a moonless night. Ocean Drive dripped its neon across a dying street, across a concrete wall, over sand dunes, all the way to shore. Eerie exit sign green, Barbie doll pink, they were awash in the palette of a night all wrong. Jeanette spotted the hand first, bloated, palm up on the wet sand. Skin purple red like a heart carved out of the body. She cheered it on even. Yes, my little heart, run to sea and leave this moment. Then she followed the lines and angles and a fuller graph appeared. An arm as the water receded, bobbing breasts as the water rushed back. Holy fuck, she whispered. Shock gave her strength she couldn't muster a moment before. Jeanette dug her heels into the sand and pushed Johnson off. He tumbled onto his side, onto his elbow. What the fuck? He followed her gaze. Water receding. Body. Fuck. They scrambled to their feet. Jeanette's tank top was bunched under her armpits. Her nipples poked through a mesh purple bra. She pulled her top down and her denim shorts up from her ankles. They stepped closer to the water's edge, but stopped before the body, like an invisible perimeter, held them back. Johnson said the obvious, something like, holy shit, it's a dead body. The body was of a woman, perhaps in her 40s, perhaps in her 60s. It was impossible to tell. What do we do? She managed. The dead woman's eyes were open, the pupils fixed on some faraway horizon. They were milky, looked like they'd be pebble hard to the touch. And the mouth was slightly parted, like death had come as she said something innocuous. How's the weather over there? Mouth barely closing over air. Ugh, I don't know. Fuck, I'm so high. Okay, give me a moment. I need to think. Give me a moment. Johnson ran a hand through the wisps of hair left on his almost bald head. A moment ago, Jeanette had thought she'd reached the precipice of who she wanted to be. Thought she'd finally walk the halls of Gables High like a harder girl. Like the ones with boyfriends who didn't have to lie about sexual experience. They'd always both intrigued and frightened her. She knew they knew of things she only read about in romance paperbacks with worn spines or watched on HBO late at night with the volume muted so her parents wouldn't hear. She believed the harder girls, the cooler girls, were contagious, and she, dripping with want, could siphon their cool. She'd tried to move in their orbit, hoped they'd see her as one of their own. But until this night, she had lived with fear they'd find her out for the girl she really was. Now she was standing in front of a dead body and knew of things none of the cool girls would ever know. It started like this. Two girls in denim coochie cutters hanging outside a gas station. Sasha's car was parked in an IHOP lot. They'd just finished eating a stack of pancakes for dinner. They were bored. Sasha's mom was at her boyfriend's place in West Palm Beach, where she spent most weekends. Jeanette's mother was home recovering from a tummy tuck. Her father was home drunk. They'd split a joint and hotbox Sasha's car at the car wash. They did that often. Selected a deluxe Super Plus wash, which meant the car went in and they didn't have to pull out for like 15 minutes. So nice to be pulled along, car moving on its own, no decisions. In a haze of smoke, Jeanette had watched automatic rollers paint Sasha's windshield with giant, clumsy, felt robot hands. The robot and Jeanette had blown hot air at each other. Then, giggling, they'd rolled into the sunshine, opening the windows to air the car as a bored young worker took Sasha's money and shook his head in disbelief and probably a bit of jealousy. Then IHOP. Then they'd wanted cigarettes. That's why they went to the gas station. Jeanette and Sasha had a routine. They stood off to the side by the quarter air pumps, out of the sight line of whoever managed the cash register inside the shop. They watched for the right kind of guy getting out of his car. The best bets were guys over 30, without girlfriends or wives or kids in the car. Jeanette was better at asking than Sasha. She'd never said it to Sasha's face, of course, but Jeanette knew it was because she was prettier. Sasha, with her small chest and habit of wearing headbands, looked younger. The only guys who had eyed Sasha at the gas station were the really old ones, and they had agreed to draw the line at 60. Old guys were creepy. That Saturday, Jeanette had tried one guy before Johnson. The guy had been in his 30s, maybe, with a crew cut and a tattoo of Florida that said, "God bless the Gunshine State," in old English letters below. She was sure he'd buy them a pack. But he'd brushed Jeanette aside with laughter while scanning her body and lifting the gas pump from its holster. "Sweetie, I'm on parole and you aren't worth it," he'd said. She was mortified. So she tried extra hard with the next guy, with Johnson. Adjusted her bra so extra cleavage spilled over her orange top, sucked her stomach in, reapplied strawberry lip smackers and a light brown lip liner. She dabbed some CK1 between her boobs. Johnson pulled up in a beat-up blood-red Toyota. He looked like a dad or like one of Sasha's mother's boyfriends, in camouflage shorts and a white t-shirt that read Tony's Tackle and Bait Shop in faded blue. He had green eyes and acne scars, muscular arms that strained his shirt sleeves. The Toyota had dark tinted windows. Jeanette chewed her gum as she walked up to him. She smiled, her most pleasant smile, the kind her dad liked. "Smile, it's your best feature," he'd say to her as she left the house for school each morning. Johnson looked up with his wallet in his hand. Sweat beaded on his forehead. She said hello and he sized her up, didn't return her smile. "I was wondering," Jeanette chewed her bottom lip and looked toward the shop door. A laminate tacked to the glass read, "Employees do not have access to safe." "Me and my friend," she motioned toward Sasha with her chin, "we want to buy cigarettes, but we forgot our IDs. If I give you the money, would you buy us a pack of Marlboro menthols, the green pack?" She held out a crumpled 20, gave her best smile again. Johnson squinted. "How old are you?"
18.
He frowned and cocked his head, softened into a smile. "What if I don't want your money? What if I do it as a favor?" The night was sticky, and Johnson's hand left a moist imprint on his wallet. His eyes were on Jeanette's chest, and she knew she had him. She brought her arms closer together. The cross of her gold chain disappeared between mounds of flesh. "You don't have to do that," she said. It was uncomfortable enough to ask for cigarettes. Jeanette didn't know how to accept additional favors. She glanced toward Sasha, but Sasha chewed a fingernail, not paying attention. "It'd be my pleasure," Johnson said. "Maybe you can pay me some other way." That's it.
Wow, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
It was such a pleasure to hear you read. So speaking of reading, we have a few questions for you still. Are you reading anything good right now of other people's work?
Yeah, I have been reading Anthony Vesna-So's forthcoming collection, which comes out in August. He tragically passed away before his debut story collection.
Oh.
Yeah, it's called After Parties, and it's really, really excellent. Just beautiful writing. Highly recommend.
Oh, good. I wanted to find out, do you have a large writing community around you? Like, who are your people, or what's your writing world like?
Yeah, I love the writing community out here in the Bay Area. I mean, I only lived here for like 6 months before the pandemic. So I haven't gotten to sort of be in community as much, and I'm sort of rejoining that. But I'm part of the Ruby, which is this kind of co-working space, but also just community of writers and artists who are all women or non-binary people. And it's run by the author Rachel Kong. And that's been a beautiful community to be a part of. And we're sort of restarting in-person stuff, and that's been great. But yeah, I mean, there's so many great writers out here. I was also part of the Steinbeck Fellowship at San Jose State University, which I'm still in contact with a lot of my cohort and a lot of the writers who are part of that. So there's a really wonderful writing community out here.
That sounds great. Both of those groups sound really wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think so many of the writers that we speak to talk about the importance of community and how it keeps people motivated doing work. Speaking of which, here's a question. What do you struggle with the most in this field, being a writer? And also, what brings you the greatest joy about it?
That's such a great question. I mean, I think like many writers, the hardest part of writing is the writing, sort of showing up to the page, sort of silencing the very critical parts of my mind when it comes time to create. That's always the challenge. And especially when I'm sort of no one's holding my feet to the fire and giving me deadlines, and it's just up to me to sort of work on my writing projects. It can be very easy to sort of shy away from the writing. And the joy, I think, putting out a piece of writing into the world and hearing from people who connect with it in the sort of ways that I hoped has been really exciting and fulfilling. And also just when I encounter writing that speaks to me or that sort of puts to words maybe something I've always felt but not been able to articulate. It's so exciting to me to be able to access someone's creativity and mind in that way.
Oh, yeah. Well, do you anticipate more work coming with such a women-intensive focus as this book has had?
I think I'm always going to be interested in writing about women and relationships between women. My next project will probably be vastly different from this one, but I think I'll always be interested in women's stories.
Yeah, same.
Great. Well, can you tell us a little bit more about if you have anything in the works right now, anything anticipated for the next year in terms of where your literary focus will go?
I wish I did. I have not started on my next novel or larger project. I've been mostly focused on short stories and poems. So
yeah, and probably promoting this book too. That takes a lot of time and energy when you're promoting.
Yes, and feels like very different parts of my brain. So it's been sort of hard to get back into the writing. But I do hope to start on the larger project soon.
Well, we've got one last question for you. I always like to ask what an author has learned on their road to becoming an author and what advice you would offer to new writers. I know you said reading poetry is something that you would say. Do you have any other suggestions for an aspiring author?
That's a great one. Yeah, I think coming back to the idea of community, I think writing can be a really solitary pursuit in a lot of ways and a really challenging one, full of rejection for every single writer. And I think what has really sustained me has been community and other writers at sort of the same stage of their writing path. And I think that's super important. And if there's not a sort of automatic built-in community the way you might have with like an MFA program, I think creating that community and connecting to other writers is really important.
Yeah, that's a great, great suggestion. Well, excellent. Thank you so much for spending time with us today at Book Tales. We really enjoy talking with you and hearing you read from your work.
Yes. Thank you. And everybody, please order Gabriella's book of Women and Salt. And be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the Book Tales readings and drinks. Also, subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month, for more conversation with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.
Thank you.